Preston and Steve Fun Size Podcast.
We are excited to have our next guest in because he's always really cool to talk to. And he is winner of a very prestigious award. It is the greatest honor bestowed by the world-renowned New York-based Explorers Club. And it is the Explorers Club Medal Award, which is awarded for extraordinary contributions directly in the field of exploration, science research, or to the welfare of humanity. And he joined some pretty big company in winning this award and has been by here on a number of occasions. Please welcome our dinosaur buddy. What just happened? Are you serious? This is the BS version of that?
I didn't know that.
Let me back this up.
It was hitting a perfect crescendo.
I hit the crescendo right at the moment that the squeaky gate makes the same sound as Jurassic Park, which was right here.
I bet you if I were to hit this button, it would go away.
I
hit undo.
Do it. God, I was really building them up.
It was perfect.
There you go,
and
Preston.
Then the Preston and Steve show happened.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, Kenneth Lacavara is here this morning. How are you, Kenneth?
I'm doing great.
Nice to see you.
How about that intro?
I mean,
we just eradicated all your life's work.
I was selling it.
With a squeaky gate.
Oh, my God. Well, it's nice to see you, man. Congratulations, by the way. We're very
really
happy to hear about you winning this award.
Thank you very much.
I mean, he's a heavy hitter.
It's huge. And to bring people back up to speed, if you don't know Kenneth by name, Ken was the one who discovered Dreadnoughtus, the largest... I mean, it outweighed T-Rex by 65 tons, this outrageous discovery that you found. And every time you've been here, we always get emails and texts that come in like, I could listen to this guy talk all day because of the really cool stuff that you've experienced and were able to tell us about. So just to let people know who we're talking to. But when did you get word that you were receiving this award?
I got word in November. The president of the Explorers Club called me up. He didn't even say hello. I answered the phone. He said, what do Ken Lacavara and Neil Armstrong have in common?
Wow.
And I said, born on Earth?
Yeah. And so that's a cool way to lead with. But yes, some of the other recipients are, as Preston noted, you're in extraordinarily good company. I mean, when you do what you do for a living and you're inquisitive and you're ensconced and, into all of this stuff, you don't impress me as the kind of guy who's going, I hope I win an award for this. Mm-hmm. But to get it has certainly got to be rewarding.
It's amazing. It's so humbling to be added to a list of so many of my childhood heroes. It's just incredible.
It's so humbling that Ken is wearing the award right now.
Yes.
As he came in here this morning. I would, too.
Absolutely.
I wore it to the Wawa the other day.
Did you? I don't know if you're married, but wear that to ladies' night someplace. You'll do great.
Wow. So you guys had a ceremony, obviously, for this up in New York City. Tell us a little bit about that.
It was the Explorers Club annual dinner, the 115th. It's in Times Square at the Marriott Marquis, 1,700 people there in tuxedos and ball gowns. This was a very special dinner in that this is the 50th anniversary of the Apollo landing.
Which is amazing. They have the movie, the documentary coming out about the, with new footage. So
that's amazing. I saw it the other night.
Oh, you did?
It's incredible.
That's so incredible that you were there for that anniversary.
So there were 10 Apollo astronauts at the dinner.
No kidding.
Great.
Who was there?
Buzz Aldrin, Michael Collins.
Wow.
My son got to sit next to Fred Hayes from Apollo 13 at lunch.
Yeah. Freddie Hayes.
Fredo.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Rusty Swikart. It was just amazing.
We're huge fans of this, the history of the space program, and, going back to, beginning with, Chuck Yeager and even before that, and following the whole genesis of everything. This is it's a different breed of person, is it not? Those original space explorers.
Absolutely. Those guys just had, ice in their blood. They were just men of steel. I can't believe if you see that Apollo 11 documentary, which I really recommend, it just really brings home just how tough these guys were.
Is it like being in prison? Ken, one of these guys next to you goes, what are you here for? I found a dinosaur. What did you do? I flew to the moon.
It's kind of like that. The president of the club actually starts off the dinner by saying, who's been to Antarctica? Well, almost everybody raises their hand. Who's climbed Mount Everest? There's probably 200 people that raise their hand.
Wow.
Who's been to the bottom of the ocean, the Marianas Trench? A dozen people. Yeah. Who's been to the moon? 10 people.
Yeah. Wow. So cool.
But you know, with a name like Explorers Club, there's got to be a guy in a pith helmet with a monocle on or something like that that's there.
It's totally what you think it is.
Is it? Yeah, really? Somebody walked out of Jumanji?
The Explorers Club itself looks like you think it would. Lots of dark wood paneling, lots of taxidermy, all kinds of artifacts of exploration.
Yeah. Hey, who was the first recipient when it was started?
The first recipient was Admiral Perry.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
That's a good choice.
1904.
So were you this year's lone recipient
of
that medal?
Yes.
No kidding.
No one could compete.
Wow. And so all these astronauts and all these other esteemed fellows and women and so forth are there to watch, you know, I guess that they do a video presentation of what you have been up to.
They
and
did.
On.
There was kind of like, you know, the Olympic intro video type of thing.
Yeah.
And
was there a blooper reel? Like, oh, I'm sorry, I said Stegosaurus.
I was saving that for the President's Steve show. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
So how long does your presentation where they're honoring you? Is it like, you know, 15, 20 minutes or?
It's about 10 minutes.
Well, still that's in front of all of those legendary people. Tell me you teared up a little bit.
I didn't tear up. You know, I'm an explorer. I can't tear up.
Dude, I'm cool.
I'm looking at the list of past recipients, and Jane Goodall's on there. Bob Ballard, James Cameron, Neil deGrasse Tyson was a couple of years ago. Of all of the past recipients, besides the astronauts, who else was in attendance?
Oh, Kathy Sullivan was there. I sat with her. She was the first woman to walk in space.
Wow.
Sylvia Earle was there, otherwise known as Her Deepness. She's the first woman to descend to the bottom of the Marianas Trench.
Oh, my God.
7 miles under the ocean.
These are the coolest people that have ever...
Yeah.
Ever. You could sit. So how do you fight the urge to engage every one of them in lengthy conversation? Because the truth of the matter is with the Marianas Trench, and we talk about this all the time. I think we might have talked about it with you at one time or another. The depths of our own oceans are as alien to us in many ways as deep space. We haven't spent a lot of time researching. So, you know, are you equally as fascinated with that aspect of
absolutely.
Exploration?
I'm a total fanboy when I'm there. These are my heroes. And you're right. We know more about the surface of Mars than we do about the bottom of the ocean.
Which is wild because it's right here.
Yeah.
Hang on. I'm clicking on somebody named Thor Herendahl. Who apparently won the award one time. Now, with a name like that alone.
Is he the one who recreated the... No, I'm thinking of...
Thor Heyerdahl?
Thor Heyerdahl.
Kon-Tiki.
Oh, that's him. Yeah. Thor Heyerdahl. What did he do?
He went across the ocean in a boat that he made out of reeds.
It was an Academy Award-winning documentary.
Yeah. No kidding.
To show that it was possible for, you know, ancient people to cross seas.
Sure,
so
I remember
you're
that.
In the same company as that guy.
That lunatic.
Yes.
Wow. That's an incredible thing. So I assume the after party was some kind of rave, I assume, with glow sticks and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. You should...
Typical.
We're looking on Wikipedia. Your name has not appeared on here yet, but they'll have to put that on there because they only go up to 2018. But.
What are some of the added benefits? Or not that they, you know, this is certainly benefit enough. But what else are you privy to now that you have won this this accolade?
Well, you know, I guess it's kind of my calling card now. I suppose
right
helps to sell books, doesn't it?
I hope so. Yeah,
you're working on a new one.
I am working on a new one.
So you've written one.
That's
right?
Correct.
Right, and it certainly. Where's the title? Why Dinosaurs Matter. Yes,
it's a great book. I've read it. My son's read it, and this came out. It was a TED Talk as well, right? It was featured on the TED Talk.
Based on a TED Talk.
Yeah, and so do you think that the writing of the book was one of the main reasons why you were given this award? And I don't mean this in a slighting way at all, but why do you think you won the award?
I don't really know what the selection committee discussed. That, you know, certainly Dreadnoughtus has something to do with it. I think also that, you know, I've really tried to not just focus on the science, but on getting the science out to the public.
You do a great job, by the way. There are certain people are imbued with that gift to, for lack of a better phrase, dumb down, you know, but still maintain the sense of excitement about this stuff. And you do that very well. As far as you with Dreadnoughtus, you discovered, you know, a new dinosaur. What is the frequency of that? You know, it's not often, right? When was the last one discovered before Dreadnoughtus?
Well, it's increasingly frequent. 100 years ago, it was one a year.
One a year.
In the 70s, it was a half a dozen a year.
Really?
It's about one a week now.
Are you serious?
It's incredible.
So what? Dreadnoughtus, obviously, wow, buried sheer size.
Dreadnoughtus was special in that it's the most complete by far of the supermassive dinosaurs, and it's also the largest dinosaur for which we can calculate a weight at about 65 tons.
65 tons. So stuff has been coming out about, for example, recently about T-Rex, and I think it might have been the Museum of Natural History has put together what they believe is the most accurate depiction to date of T-Rex, and it's slightly different. There appears to be like a bristly, furry kind of thing. Describe what they come up. Do you agree with that, by the way?
I do. T-Rex almost certainly had feathers. Birds are dinosaurs. Birds are not related to dinosaurs. They didn't evolve from dinosaurs. They're dinosaurs. So if you look at where T-Rex fits in its family tree, on one side, its cousins would be birds. On the other side are these tiny little dinosaurs that are preserved with feathers. We can see that they're feathered.
Right.
So the simplest explanation is to think that since T-Rex has a common ancestor, that they all got those feathers from a common ancestor, and therefore T-Rex should have some kind of feathers or down or quills or something
like that.
Would
it be, because what they depicted shows more like a bristly quill type thing as opposed to lush, you know, plumage, you know, so...
That's kind of a compromise. We don't really know. T-Rex hasn't been found with feathers because the kind of sediment that you need to preserve feathers is fine grain mud and silt. And that's not the kind of environment where you're going to preserve the really big bones of a T-Rex. You need sandstone washed in by a river or something like that.
So like a fabulous T-Rex is what we were...
They're fancy and deadly.
Feather bones.
Yes.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, I'm sorry to jump in here, Nick. We saw a story that we chatted about not that long ago that some... prints were found at Valley Forge. Mm-hmm. And what did you hear about that? These were permanent prints. I forgot what the technical term is when you find those.
Yeah, that's right. So dinosaur bones have never been found in Pennsylvania because of the Appalachians, it sheds sediment, which forms the coastal plain and the continental shelf. But there are impressions from Triassic age rocks. So that goes back about 200 million years ago. And those rocks are forming as the Atlantic Ocean is forming. So we had Pangaea. That was all the continents were together. As Pangaea starts to rip apart, that happens right here in Pennsylvania. And it's a very arid environment. We've got dinosaurs stomping around in these mud beds. And some of them get preserved. And they've been found in Pennsylvania right here.
Freaking love this. So you're saying when Pangaea broke apart, one of the tear lines, where approximately do we think it is in relationship to Pennsylvania?
It's exactly here. It's right on the Piedmont that Philadelphia is built on.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And holy hell!
If you learn the geology of the Appalachians, you already know the geology of parts of Scotland and of the Atlas Mountains in Morocco, because before the Atlantic opened, they were all the same
joined
mountains.
That is... I'm sorry. It tweaks my melon. It's effing crazy, but it's so cool.
I've mentioned a book a few times on the show. It's called A Brief History of Nearly Everything. Bill Bryson's the author of it. And what's amazing to me is that book came out in around 2002 or 2003, and he writes frequently about what we don't know.
Yeah.
And the discoveries that have been made over the last 100 years, over the last 200 years, and people are constantly discovering new things. And the science behind them, to me, is fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about recent discoveries that in your field in paleontology that we didn't have any idea existed, say, 20 years ago or so?
Sure. Well, I think, we're increasingly learning that dinosaurs were more diverse and really more magnificent than we ever knew. We're finding just these bizarre things. Last year, a dinosaur was published from the tar sands of Alberta in Canada. This thing's preserved in 3D. It's like being in a room with a dinosaur. You can see every scale. You can see its armor. You can see, little tiny details in its face and its lips. So we're really getting a much better picture. So many of the dinosaurs on that meat-eating branch that's closely related to birds, we're finding had feathers. And there was a paper out just a couple weeks ago that showed that dinosaur biodiversity was doing just fine before that asteroid hit. They were on every continent. They were flourishing. And they would probably still be here were it not for that cosmic accident.
Planet killer. So there was a story about, I don't know what, I briefly saw it in passing, that there is a larger than had originally anticipated asteroid passing close, I think closer than the moon's orbit to Earth, correct?
Yeah, we do not know where all the Earth-crossing asteroids are.
Yeah.
And, the last one to hit us is not the one that ended the time of the dinosaurs. There's going to be another someday. And we really need to track all these things and develop the technology to get out there and divert them before they hit our planet.
How good or how are you ever consulted on this? Or is this, because this is... it's one of those elusive questions. I know people are spending time, obviously, trying to investigate this, and there are actually plans in the works for diversion programs, right?
Yeah, I had breakfast last Monday with Rusty Swikart, Apollo astronaut, and he runs a foundation called the B612 Foundation, dedicated to planetary protection, to try to discover where all these killer asteroids are and to lobby countries to really, you know, make a way to deflect
them. To deflect things. Them.
Yeah. Nick was talking about new discoveries. Do they come along from time to time and make scientists such as yourself rethink a lot of the past of what we believed? And now, oh, my God, we got to factor this whole thing in, too?
They do. Generally, the way science works is you have incremental discoveries that kind of creep upon you year after year, and then something comes through, and it's a total paradigm shift.
Yeah.
That happened in 1980 when the Alvarezes published their idea that the dinosaurs died from a meteor impact. Before that, we really had no idea what happened to them.
That's as recent as the 80s, the concept of death due to a sort of a planet killer.
Yeah, and at the time, it was thought of just one of a number of crackpot theories, like mammals ate all their eggs, or this was a published paper, all the fiber-rich plants died out and the dinosaurs perished of constipation.
And when you read things like that, it makes me think of, what are we getting wrong now?
Yeah.
You know, and what theories are sort of established as actual fact, but maybe that's not quite the fact. You know, do you think about that?
Oh, sure. If history is a guide, future scientists will look at our work and they'll think, well, that was a really good idea, and that was a really good idea. But all the rest of that stuff is really quaint and kind of cute that they actually thought that. You know? Yeah.
Well, for science to exist properly, there always has to be a re-examination. And nothing should ever be over, you know, I mean, it's the whole scientific method. You need to keep retesting and checking for the validity, correct?
That's right. Science is self-correcting.
Right.
That's what separates science from dogma or philosophy or religion or politics. It's not a belief system. We check and recheck, and we're constantly trying to falsify our own ideas and our colleagues' ideas.
All right. Two things here that are on my mind recently. There was an article, I think it was in the New York Times, talking about UFOs. And that there has been a little bit of a shift now in the world of science about perceiving the possibility of alien. You know, for a while we were taught, okay, it's too expensive that races could have crossed time or whatever to come here and so on and so forth. But that shifted a little bit. Was that article A, accurate, and B, where do you stand on this? That we're actually have been and continue to be visited by extraterrestrials.
Well, life evolves from natural processes.
Right.
And NASA and JPL, they're now discovering a new planet outside of our solar system literally every day.
Right.
There are thousands now of those planets that fall into what they call the Goldilocks zone.
Right.
You know, not too hot, not too cold, an Earth-like planet. And we know that life evolves from natural processes. So do I think this is the only place in the universe where there's life? No, certainly. That's impossible. Is there evidence that alien life has visited the planet? No, I don't think there is. And there is a lot of space in space.
Yeah. Right, yes.
If you look at our nearest neighbor, Alpha Centauri, that's about 4.3 light years away. That's the same as if you took a grapefruit and set it on your desk here. That would be the sun. The Earth would be a grain of sand 50 yards away. Alpha Centauri would be a grapefruit in Denver.
Yeah. Wow.
And that's our next door buddy.
Right, right. As close as it gets, yeah. It's massive.
Alpha Centauri is always is the go-to in science fiction, though, for the planet to get. In fact, you think in Lost in Space, they were traveling to Alpha Centauri.
Sure. It's around the corner.
It's around the corner, yeah. It's so easy to get to.
If you're just tuning in, Kenneth Lacavaro is here, and he's a friend of the show, and recently won the Explorers Club Medal Award, a very exclusive club that he's in, a very, very prestigious award. So obviously they focused on Dreadnoughtus and your book and all that stuff. What are you working on right now? Because last time you were here, we heard about finding out the origins of our being, I guess, somewhere in a Home Depot parking lot or something like that.
Yeah, well, this is really what I'm most excited about now, which is the Edelman Fossil Park of Rowan, New Jersey, of Rowan University. And we have this amazing site there, which I think holds the key to the extinction of the dinosaurs. We actually can see the bones and the skeletons of creatures that died that day in that pivotal, calamitous moment that wiped out 75% of life on the planet and really made the modern world as we know it. But better yet, we have about 25 feet of sediment above that that's full of fossils, and we can let the public collect from those layers when we have special events. So
you oversee so that no incredible find is being dismissed out of turn. So I love this, that this here, because I always thought there's history to all of the area, obviously, and prehistoric history, and obviously, but I always thought we were kind of like a more dull, part of the world for that. But now to have this here, you know, which could be, again, another major finding, is phenomenal. And it is, Preston, not kidding, it's basically almost adjacent to a Home Depot parking lot.
It's behind a Lowe's in Manhattan.
A Lowe's. Yes. Okay. Lowe's. Yep. Yes.
And we are, we're building a $57 million museum there right now. We've got architects working on it today. And Southern New Jersey is really the cradle of dinosaur paleontology. Dinosaurs are first recognized in England, but they can't really figure out what they are. That's why they get that name dinosaur. It means terrible lizard in 1842. Yeah. In 1858, the first real skeletons found in Haddonfield, New Jersey. And then in 1866, the first tyrannosaur is found in Mantua Township in South Jersey.
That is so awesome.
Yeah.
Bones?
Yeah, bones.
No, alive!
I didn't... Here's the deal. So, as a kid growing up, my sister would always find four-leaf clovers.
Yeah.
She'd find arrowheads. She'd find, these things.
Yeah,
I've never found a goddamn thing in my life. And I want to find a fossil. I want to go to the dig. But I don't want to find it at a dig.
Yeah,
I want to stumble across something. Casey went to the Grand Canyon last year. And I would imagine that area is littered with stuff like that.
It is, yeah.
What do you, when you guys are looking, you just throw a dart and go, let's start digging over there and take a look. Or how do you narrow down what's going to be, quote unquote, fertile ground for this stuff?
We all use the same formula. It's not just dumb luck. We have to find rocks of the right age, depending on what you're interested in.
Yeah.
They have to be sedimentary rocks so that a fossil could have formed. And then today, it needs to be an arid environment where you get good exposure of the rocks and good rates of erosion pushing back the hillsides, or an artificial quarry like we have in New Jersey. And then you just get yourself on the ground and you walk.
And it just takes an investment of time.
Obviously,
I find that the harder I work, the luckier I get.
Yeah.
You got to know what you're looking for too. Is it easy to find? Like plant fossils and things like that. Are they fairly common?
That's a different kind of prospecting.
Okay.
So you'll find plants inside the pages of shale. So you get shale.
Loads of shale out where I live. So.
Well, you can find it. You get there. You get a pile between your knees, and you get a chisel and a hammer, and you start breaking them open like the pages of books.
Yeah, because it flakes off.
Yeah.
You need to hang around with Ken and what you need to do is go back to your sister with a full Tyrannosaurus skull. Looky what I found.
I know.
Ken, I want to ask you two things before I forget. The first is, what is Buzz Aldrin like? Because I find him to just be fascinating, not to mention an American hero. And two, if we could bring dinosaurs back to life, because there have been recent discoveries that maybe there's DNA that can be injected into whatever, should we, a la Jurassic Park?
Buzz Aldrin is amazing. He's personable. He loves being Buzz Aldrin, and he's really good at it. He's got a knee-buckling handshake, and he loves to talk about the space program.
Love it.
That's cool. Good.
Yeah.
Hey, before you answer Nick's question, I think what he's bringing up is there was a story not too long ago where they had some pretty pristine mastodon tissue, and they were taking that and I guess doing what they called exciting it or something along those lines to see if there was growth that was potentially possible. And apparently the prospects were pretty positive. Now, they're saying that it's a long way off before they're going to be able to extract whatever it is they need to get to that and, you know, maybe create a living, current-day mastodon. They're working on that type of technology. What do you think, ethically, is the proper course?
Well, for animals like the mastodon, they went extinct not that long ago. The last population of mammoths went extinct while the pyramids of Giza were being built in Egypt. So they were here with us, and we killed them. So for things that we humans drove into extinction, I think the right thing to do is to bring them back. And I think we're going to have that technology pretty soon. We do have mastodon DNA. We had the...
Mm-hmm. So there was a Russian... was it a woolly mammoth? They found the actual flesh...
Yeah.
Intact?
So those are what we call sub-fossils. They're not that old. They're only thousands of years old. And they get frozen in the permafrost. When they start to weather out, wolves actually will show up and eat their flesh.
Because they sense the decaying flesh.
It's like
flesh.
Mammoth jerky.
Yeah. So do you foresee, obviously it's all speculative at this point, you know, what's the scientific consensus on the reintroduction of a species that went extinct, you know, like a dinosaur? Is that, are they in it just to see what comes from the science involved in trying to get to it, or is the end game really to do that?
There are people working on this problem right now. There are now de-extinction conferences.
Okay.
There's a guy who's bought thousands of acres in Siberia. He's calling it Pleistocene Park to reintroduce mammoths there. And these animals have a place in the ecosystem. The mammoths help recycle all that really coarse tundra of vegetation, and their scat then help the soil become more fertile and forests grow.
Wow.
For very ancient animals like dinosaurs, we don't have their DNA. We recover proteins from them, but that's a long way from DNA.
Okay.
They don't have a place in this world. This is no longer the dinosaur
world.
Well,
they could help with the deer overpopulation, maybe. You know? I mean, let's think about the positives here.
And then, of course, you got to get a Tyrannosaurus to take care of the woolly mammoths.
Before you know, you're
back to getting the mouse to scare the elephant.
That's
On the day of this planet-killing event, which now you're directly tied to with this moment in history, the initial asteroid hits the Earth. In that moment, what percentage of life on Earth was immediately exterminated? Do you know? Is there
most of what lived on land? So in the ocean, it took a little while, but it blows a hole in the ground off the coast of Mexico the size of Massachusetts by 12 miles deep. Imagine what Massachusetts weighs. So
right.
You take that rock, throw it up through the atmosphere. It goes into low Earth orbit. Now it's got a tremendous amount of potential gravitational energy. When that stuff comes in, it's got to balance the energy books. It does that. If you've seen a movie like Apollo 13 with a space capsule returning, imagine that day, trillions and trillions of little millimeter-sized space capsules, each flaming into the atmosphere, each one heating up a little parcel of air around itself. And the result is, right now the argument is, that day globally, did temperatures get up to toaster oven for a few hours or pizza oven for a few minutes?
Wow.
Either way, if you're on the surface of the planet like the dinosaurs and have no place to shelter, you die that day.
You're incinerated. Wow. Are most of them incinerated instantly?
They are.
Yeah.
There's also a magnitude 10 or 11 earthquake. There's tsunamis that might have been a mile high.
Whoa.
Landslides, a really bad day.
So what survived? How were we able to, you know, become and what lived and brought life continuously to the Earth?
To survive, you need to be small. You need to have modest needs.
Right.
And you need to have been able to get underground.
Okay.
Our ancestors at the time, we at the time, were tiny little mammals that lived in the dinosaur world for about 140 million years, living in the hidden and forgotten recesses of the saurian world, hoping never to be noticed.
Right.
And then the dinosaurs go extinct. And we climb out from our hidey holes under the blue sky. We go from nocturnal to daytime creatures and immediately start to evolve into just this, you know, cornucopia of mammals that we see today.
Was there anything ocean-related that that we believe survived through the Great Impact and then continued on through past that?
Yeah, in the ocean, the scene is, it's kind of like a parallel mass extinction. All that dust and gas in the atmosphere shrouds out the sun.
Right.
Pretty soon, the plankton can't do their thing, and it kicks out the base of the food chain.
Okay.
That ripples up quickly. So big things like those sea monsters, like mosasaurs and plesiosaurs, they start to starve. But smaller things do okay. Little fishes do okay. Some sharks go extinct, rays in particular. For animals like crocodiles and sea turtles, they burrow, and they do pretty well as well.
Well, that was going to be my question about crocodiles and alligators and so forth. They're the things that we look at mostly and go, okay, there you go. There's our dinosaurs.
Yeah, yeah.
Nowadays. But they survived from that time?
Or? Yeah, they're burrowers.
Okay. Okay,
and burrowers. So there are many crocodiles and turtles that make it through that boundary.
Okay. If the asteroid hadn't hit, can we predict how things would be different, or is that impossible?
Well, you know, we can see the dinosaurs dominate the land for 165 million years. They're doing great, and then that asteroid wipes them out. Why not another 65 million more? And if that were the case, we would still be little shrew-like animals trying to stay out of the way of the dinosaurs.
I don't like that outcome. Yeah. it's unrelentingly fascinating, you know, this stuff. So, and when is the projected date of this next book coming out?
Well, I'm working on the book right
okay,
now,
right.
So probably 2 years.
All right.
Hey, what's the most prehistoric prehistoric-like animal that's alive right now that is still existing to this day that you would say kind of goes way, way, way back? Somebody texted in and said horseshoe crabs.
Well, exactly. The horseshoe crab is a great example of that. If you look at a horseshoe crab from a half a billion years ago from the Cambrian, it looks like a horseshoe crab that you find in Cape May.
Okay. Wow.
I kind of liken the horseshoe crab. They're kind of like the Guinness beer of animals. Like Guinness makes one product. That's all they do. They've been making that same product, and it just works.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at other companies, think of like, you know, SpaceX or Google. Are they going to be here in 100 years, or is Guinness beer going to be here in 100 years? Right? And so the horseshoe crab, that just works. That's going to be here in a million years.
I saw it was one of the great BBC series, and you know, where they use the computer graphics to give you an idea of what things look like. And they had projected a future evolution past man where perhaps the octopus would morph into something, a sentient creature that was sort of a the next replacement to us. Just wild hypothesis, or do you see any credence to that?
Well, the octopus is really smart. That's probably as close as we can get to, you know, looking at an alien life form that occurs right here on Earth. But the thing about evolution is there's no trajectory, there's no momentum. It's all about the now. It's all about, are you able to have more babies than this person over here? And are they going to survive? And if that's the case, your genes get passed on and those genes don't. It's just about the now.
Sort of a crapshoot then, right, in a way?
Yeah.
Based on those various variables. Wow.
Kenneth, we got a lot of people that are texting in that are big fans of yours. Do you speak in front of groups? Are there people that can come and see you? You know, how can people access you if they want to learn more about this?
I do. I speak frequently. You can email us at fossils@rowan.edu. I have a speakers bureau, actually, and so I go out and I speak with the American Program Bureau.
Okay. Wow, it's just it's fascinating stuff. It's so cool, and we're really, really excited that you got this honor. And that's just another feather, another dinosaur feather in your cap.
And we're glad you have no taste and still come to this show thinking that it's a proper thing to do. Yeah.
Well, it's cool. It's great if you're just tuning in, Kenneth Lacavara, and he has won this wonderful honor. It's called the Explorers Club Medal. And did they just hand out one a year, I guess, or
one a year?
Yeah. One a year. Wow.
Sometimes not one a year.
No kidding.
Yeah.
All right. That's phenomenal.
Is that pure gold on your neck there? What's that made of? Is that
I
velvet?
Don't think so. I haven't hit it yet.
until he gets to his car, it's fake.
Right. Yeah. No chocolate on the inside.
Well, that's awesome. Congratulations, Kenneth. Always great to have you by here.
Thank you so much.
It. And by the way, the name of his book, Why Dinosaurs Matter, and you will definitely want to check that out. Kenneth J. Lacavara, guys. Theological professor and winner of the Explorers Medal, Club Medal.
Very cool.
More podcasts from Preston and Steve available at PrestonandSteve.com.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top 5 Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.